Today is Tuesday, November 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Hong Kong police say the city's rule of law is at the brink of total collapse as protests hit the Central Financial District and two universities.
In the most alarming incident, rioters throw chairs and traffic cones from a footbridge onto the moving vehicles.
Also ahead, public impeachment hearings begin tomorrow in Washington, and we have a preview. And Gambia files a case in the International Criminal Court against Myanmar. Those stories and more are next. Hong Kong's senior superintendent of public relations, Kong Wing Chong, said the city's rule of law is at the brink of total collapse as protests hit the Central Financial District and two universities on Tuesday.
Mass mob wreaks havoc in different universities. In the most alarming incident, rioters throw chairs and traffic cones from a footbridge onto the moving vehicles underneath near to the University of Hong Kong. The chairs dropped from the bridge hit the feet of an innocent motorbike driver, causing him to lose balance. It's clearly a murderous act that could have killed the poor innocent driver. This shows rioters' violence is not only reckless, but also random. Anyone could have been the next victim without any prior warning.
The clashes came a day after police shot a protester at close range. Hong said the police had countless examples of rioters using random and indiscriminate violence against innocent people.
In one of the most shocking cases so far, a 57-year-old man was burned alive by rioters in Ma On Shan yesterday. The victim got into a dispute with rioters over political views and was then beaten up brutally. He suffered bloody head injury before being pulled with flammable fluid and set on fire. He is now in critical condition in hospital, suffering severe burns to his head and upper body. The case is classified as attempted murder under the investigation of Commercial Crime Bureau.
Several people were wounded Tuesday, including a student reporter who was hit in the eye. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam on Monday said protesters were being extremely selfish and hoped that universities and schools would urge students not to take part in the demonstrations. Now, for more on the ground, I spoke with reporter Stephen Boitano, and I began our conversation by asking him if the police claim that the rule of law was on the brink of collapse was accurate.
Bring it total collapse? No. No, it's protests. Basically, as they've been, they've stepped it up. The protesters have stepped it up in certain areas. But total collapse, no. Most of Hong Kong is completely normal. Just the hot spots where there's stuff going on. The police are handling what's happening. They'll come in with tear gas and rubber bullets, and they'll stop it from happening. It's just that so much is happening, they're overwhelmed. And, you know, the vandalism and... it goes on, and you know there's no indication that they're going to bring out the PLA. That would be a huge escalation, and it's not at that point yet.
What do you mean?
Yeah.
What do you mean by the police are overwhelmed?
Well, you know, the thing is, like, I was in Mong Kok last night, and it goes on all night. The protesters are vandalizing, they're making roadblocks, they're building fires, and the police come, you know. I don't know how many police there were, maybe 50 to 100. They come, they cordon off an area, they try to, you know, shoot people with a water cannon, and then they leave. And then the protesters come right back. There's no way, there's so many protesters there. The sheer numbers the police can't handle. And they can't stop everyone, you know, so they're overwhelmed. They can't handle what's happening.
Is there a sense that the authorities don't have a firm handle on what to do since they are so outnumbered?
What they're doing is stopping things that are happening immediately. Don't know what to do. What they should do is have some dialogue with the protesters, but that they're not going to do that. Beijing's not going to back down. So what they're doing is they're just using force, using more extreme force, and they'll stop what they can stop. but they can't stop everyone because there's too many, you know, 12, 18 locations at the same time, and they can't stop that.
That was reporter Stephen Boitano speaking to me from Hong Kong. Washington said it condemns the violence on all sides and extended its sympathies to victims of violence regardless of their political inclinations, and called for all parties, police and protesters, to exercise restraint. Members of the U.S. House of Representatives Intelligence Committee are making final preparations for the first public hearings in the impeachment investigation of President Donald Trump. Wednesday's witnesses include William Taylor, the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires in Ukraine, and George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the European and Eurasian Bureau. Both Taylor and Kent are among the current and former diplomatic and national security officials who have already given testimony behind closed doors. Joining us on the phone now is VOA congressional reporter Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
You're so welcome.
So, Catherine, what can we expect tomorrow as these hearings get underway?
We can expect to see in open for the first time a laying out of this entire timeline related to President Trump's phone call with the Ukrainian President Zelensky, which got this whole thing started 2 months ago, which prompted the whistleblower complaint, which then caused the U.S. House of Representatives to launch a formal impeachment inquiry and have those investigations behind closed doors. What we do know, of course, is that House Republicans hated the secrecy, the lack of transparency. What they said wasn't enough openness with the American public. They called for those hearings to be made open. And now that they are, we're going to see a lot more back and forth between the two parties, between Democrats and Republicans, who are really arguing this question at the heart of American democracy is, what did President Trump do, and was it wrong enough to warrant impeachment?
And speaking about that, I mean, the Democrats have come out and said that this may be an impeachable offense, looking at the memorandum of the phone call and everything that has come out through the closed doors hearings. What do we know about the Republican strategy during these hearings?
Well, we're hearing that they're shifting a little bit as these impeachment hearings go public. And what they're going to argue is that President Trump's state of mind was that he wasn't interested in a quid pro quo, that kind of exchange of favors, the exchange of the $400 million in congressionally approved aid to Ukraine in return for this assistance digging up dirt on Trump's political rival, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter. They're going to argue that the president never had a quid pro quo in his intentions, and so he couldn't have committed an impeachable offense.
Now, we're having testimony tomorrow with William Taylor and George Kent. Friday, we have Maria Yovanovitch, the former ambassador to Ukraine. What do we know about that upcoming testimony?
Well, we do know that she's going to testify that there was a quid pro quo. That's what we know from those closed-door transcripts that the House Intelligence Committee has been releasing over this past week. So we actually have a pretty good idea of what people are going to be saying this week anyway. The big question is, how will it play on television? How will it play out as we see the Republicans and the Democrats alternating their questions? What will be that moment that everybody will remember and take away from as this country is really debating whether or not President Trump should be impeached or not?
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional reporter. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
This week, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits Washington to meet with President Donald Trump. The meeting is seen as an opportunity to reset relations that have been strained over numerous policy differences. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkey's military operation against the Syrian Kurdish militia is expected to top the agenda of talks between President Erdogan and President Trump. Ankara designates the militia terrorists, but the militia is a key ally in the U.S.-led war against the Islamic State. The U.S. Congress is threatening widespread sanctions against Turkey, some of which target Erdogan personally. This week's presidential meeting comes at a key moment in relations between the NATO allies.
There is a long list of problems between the two countries. In fact, the relationship has never been as bad as it is today. And, of course, there is an ongoing matter, which is the Turkish incursion in Syria and U.S. objections What's happening on the ground is still extremely volatile.
Despite escalating bilateral tensions, the two presidents appear to have built a good working relationship, a personal chemistry that Ankara believes can offer a chance of a reset.
The summit will be beneficial for the both sides. I'm looking the optimistic perspective. This will be bringing new solutions and new methodologies between the two actors.
But some analysts warn Ankara relying solely on Trump to resolve differences may be a risky strategy.
Huge strategic mistake on the part of Ankara was to build the entire relationship, to reduce it all on President Trump, one man, and it, you know, and basically his tweets. And that is a very risky proposition. I'd say that's a Russian roulette in a relationship that is almost more than a century old.
Erdogan is looking to Trump to lift an embargo on the purchase of America's latest fighter jet. Trump imposed a freeze after Ankara procured Russia's S-400 missiles. Washington is alarmed at Ankara's deepening ties with Moscow. Erdogan is expected to offer to buy America's Patriot missiles during his visit. But Ankara points out if this week's meeting with Trump doesn't deliver a reset in ties, Moscow is waiting.
Turkey cannot continue to have the productive alliance with the U.S. while these threats continue to exist. This is not beneficial. We are looking the other side. Who is the winner of this situation? Russia and China.
Already, Turkish and Russian troops are cooperating in Syria. Russian President Vladimir Putin continues to court Erdogan. Putin is likely to be watching Erdogan's visit to Washington closely. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Bolivia's former leader, Evo Morales, has fled crisis-torn Bolivia after deadly clashes. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Bolivia is facing its worst unrest in decades amid a political vacuum, while Morales, who transformed the Andean nation as its first indigenous president, flees the country following weeks of violent protests. On Twitter, Morales said it pains him to leave the nation for political reasons, but he'll return soon, he says, with more strength and energy. Meanwhile, angry supporters set barricades ablaze, closing roads near La Paz Airport, while Morales' foes have blocked streets near Congress and the presidential palace there. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And you're listening to VOA News. I'm a
sucker for Morales. Hi, I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars.
I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without.
The CD features Billie Eilish's Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type. My
Lil Nas X, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my.
And many of the greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings. Tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says he has secured the release of two professors from the American University of Afghanistan in exchange for three captured Taliban. Reuters' Matthew Laratonda reports it's part of a wider effort to revamp negotiations to end the conflict.
Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani says his government has secured the release of two university professors, an American and an Australian, held captive by the Taliban. In exchange, he says, three captured Taliban commanders will be released. The two professors are Kevin King and Timothy Weeks, both faculty at the American University in Afghanistan, a walled compound in the capital that's been targeted multiple times in the past. King and Weeks were kidnapped 3 years ago. The prisoner swap is part of a wider effort to start direct negotiations between the Taliban and Afghan government. Previously, the Taliban have refused to deal with Kabul, who they view as a puppet of the United States. They'd rather deal with Washington directly, or Pakistan. Taliban bombings, including the death of an American soldier, prompted the U.S. to abruptly end those negotiations in September. But the White House has since tried to get talks back on track. Two of the three Taliban being released are Hafiz Rashid and Anas Haqqani. Haqqani is the younger brother of Sirajuddin Haqqani, the leader of the Haqqani Network, the most deadly faction inside the Afghan Taliban. Earlier this year, the Taliban said Anas Haqqani would be a member of any negotiating team that dealt with the United States and demanded his freedom.
And that was Reuters reporter Matthew LaRotonda. France, Germany, Britain, and the European Union say they are extremely concerned about Iran's renewed uranium enrichment activities and what they call regrettable acceleration of Iran's disengagement from commitments it made under the 2015 agreement regarding the country's nuclear program. The countries are urging Iran to reverse all of its measures it has taken that go against that imposed deal in 2015. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said said the steps are reversible if the other signatories to the agreement help Iran work around U.S. sanctions. Israel launched airstrikes Tuesday against two senior commanders from the Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad, killing one in Gaza but missing another in Syria, in a sharp escalation of Israel's regional conflict with Iran, which backs the militant group. The attack sparked an hours-long exchange of rocket fire from Gaza and further airstrikes, the worst bout of fighting there in recent months. In eastern Gaza, the Israeli strike killed Baha Abu El Atta and his wife. That set off a barrage of Gaza-fired rockets that reached as far as Tel Aviv, and the Islamic Jihad vowed further revenge. Israel's military said Abu El Atta was the mastermind of recent attacks against Israel and was the militant group's top commander in Gaza. Three other Palestinian militants were killed in additional Israeli strikes. At least 16 people are dead after two speeding trains going in opposite directions collided in eastern Bangladesh Tuesday. Authorities say the Turna-Nishita train bound for the capital of Dhaka collided with the Udayan Express train bound for the southern port city of Chittagong in the pre-dawn hours of Bahmanbaria, located east of Dhaka. The small West African nation of Gambia filed a lawsuit on Monday against Myanmar at the International Court of Justice, accusing it of perpetuating a genocide on ethnic Rohingya Muslims, which forced hundreds of thousands to flee the Asian nation. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports it is a highly unusual move for two countries not at war with each other.
Starting in August 2017, more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims quickly fled a scorched earth campaign unleashed by the Myanmar military in response to attacks by Muslim militants inside Myanmar that killed a dozen police officers. Survivors crossed the border into Bangladesh, where they gave harrowing accounts of massacres, rape, murder, and villages burned to the ground. They continued to live there in a massive refugee camp, too afraid to return to their villages in Myanmar. The Gambia is supported by the 57-member Organization for Islamic Cooperation in its complaint. Paul Riker, a Washington, D.C.-based attorney who heads the Gambian legal team, spoke to VOA about the case.
The Gambia hopes by this case, and the OIC hopes by this case, to obtain a judgment from the International Court of Justice, the highest legal authority in the international community, that Myanmar is guilty of the crime of genocide against the Rohingya people.
Such a ruling could take years. In the meantime, the lawyers are seeking an order demanding Myanmar stop harming the Rohingyas. That decision could come as early as December.
So we're hopeful to get that kind of protection for the Rohingya people very early in the case as a provisional measure so that the genocidal activities that we're seeking to end don't continue during the lawsuit.
The Myanmar government strongly disputes accusations of genocide. UN Ambassador Haudo Swan told VOA in an email that the lawsuit is a politically motivated international pressure tactic against his government and that the Gambia should mind its own business. Richard Dicker, director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, says the Gambia is within its rights to file the complaint.
Gambia has filed, in a very innovative and creative way, a complaint against the government of Myanmar that Myanmar violated its obligations as a state under the terms of the Genocide Convention. Both the Gambia and Myanmar are state members of that convention to prevent and punish genocide.
The UN has called the atrocities a textbook case of ethnic cleansing, and the head of a UN fact-finding mission said last year that estimates of 10,000 Rohingya deaths are conservative. The only other successful prosecution of a genocide case under the Genocide Convention at the ICJ was brought by Bosnia and Herzegovina against Serbia in 1993. It took 4 years for the court to issue its decision, largely in favor of Bosnia. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Tens of thousands of Australians took shelter Tuesday after authorities warned it was too late for them to leave their homes as brush fires raged across a vast area of the country's east coast. Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy has more.
The sky has turned orange in Australia, where scores of wildfires have brought parts of the country under a state of emergency. Millions are now bracing for the worst blazes in at least a decade. Officials said fires in two locations had become so severe that it was too late for people caught up in them to flee. Some residents have likened the scenes to an apocalypse or hell on earth. Lawmakers and firefighters have said they are prepared, but warned there's only so much they can do as they take on soaring heat and high winds. Bushfires are by no means uncommon in Australia, but the ferocity of these blazes that have started earlier than previous years have taken many by surprise. As the deadly fires force people out of their homes, a climate debate is taking hold in government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has declined to say whether the fires were brought on by climate change. The Deputy PM accused climate activists of politicising a tragedy. But the Mayor of Glen Innes, a town ravaged by the fires, has called on the government to listen to science.
It's not a political thing. It's a scientific fact that we are going through climate change. We are so dry in this country. We haven't had rain for years in some places. And to deny climate change is, to me, a very ill-informed and uneducated way of looking at things.
Hundreds of schools and colleges were closed on Tuesday, and Sydney, one of Australia's most iconic cities, came under a catastrophic danger warning for the first time in a decade. 70 blazes are now tearing through states, with new ones still igniting.
That was Reuters' Michelle Hennessy. Former President Jimmy Carter went under surgery today to reduce swelling in his brain, the AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
Former President Carter, who's 95 years old, has fallen several times this year, twice this month. And a spokeswoman says that's led to bleeding that's caused pressure on the brain. Doctors are planning a surgical procedure to alleviate that pressure. Carter is at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, and his wife, Rosalyn, is there, too. The oldest living former president has also battled cancer in recent years. His pastor says Monday was a rough day, and he's asking the entire country to be in prayer for Jimmy Carter. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The leaders of Spain's Socialist Party and the left-wing United We Can Party said Tuesday that they had reached a preliminary agreement to form a coalition government 2 days after a general election that was called to try and break months of political deadlock. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Nashwan Kale, and managing editor, Paul Alexander, thank you very much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news on the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.